Well, it's, I was already a travel writer, because my career's taken some weird turns along the way, because I have this philosophy that I was taught when I was young to just say yes and to new opportunities and figure it out on the fly. And what you wind up with by the time you're about to turn 50 like me is a resume that makes no sense whatsoever, but a lot of stories. And that's kind of what I wanted to do. So for a while, I wound up as a travel writer. The short version, which is not too inaccurate, is that I basically got the right guy a couple of drinks in a bar, and he turned out to be the editor of ForbesTraveler.com, and it was luxury travel. And I had this job where I got to, you know, fly literally around the world and stay in five-star luxury hotels and get paid to live like a billionaire.
So your job was to evaluate, to some extent, the best hotels in the world.
Yeah, and the thing is, I didn't even have to pick them. They were already chosen for me. It was pre-chewed. All I had to do was show up, not knock down anything that was priceless, you know, cause no international incidents, and write my little, really seriously, like 400 word pieces, these small little pieces essentially saying, yep, pretty swank. And then I would, you know, move on to the next one. So all of a sudden I go, and by the way, I'm middle class. Don't anybody get the wrong idea. My dad worked at General Motors in the warehouse. I grew up in a suburb in Ohio. My mom worked in a five and a dime. My grandfather was a coal miner. I will go Loretta Lynn on you if you need me to. And so all of a sudden, I mean, I am so out of water here. I'm walking through these palaces in like Monaco and Dubai, and I am actually literally sort of braced for some security guy to walk up to me at any moment and just grab me by the collar and just kind of smell the middle class on me and just, you know, sorry, so you must be leaving now. And it never happened. And so it was really fun for a couple months. And there was sort of a road to Damascus moment, I guess you could call it, in the Middle East. I was in Dubai, and the difference between rich and poor in the Emirates, a lot of the Gulf states, a lot of places, but where I experienced it was in Dubai, where at the time there was still this massive construction boom. Like 1/5 of all the construction cranes in the world were in Dubai at that time.
Seriously?
Yeah. Building, I mean, it was everywhere. Everything
building the world's tallest tower.
The tallest, the widest. Building, we will build the thickest one.
Building,
you know,
homemade islands for residences.
Yeah. The world development, yeah, which is still sitting out there floating around, and they deny that it's sinking. They deny it. I'll just say that. They deny it. But take a good look at Google Earth. Anyway, so I'm there in Dubai, and these places, I mean, they're just laughable on one level. I'm staying in the $3 billion Emirates Palace at the time, the most expensive hotel ever built. And they have they don't have a single soda machine in the place, because that would be, you know, way déclassé. They do, however, have an ATM that delivers gold ingots. You can just buy gold if you need it. I don't know why you'd need it, but if you need some gold to go downstairs. So this is what I'm hanging out in. But if you go outside in Dubai and you just walk 50 yards, you walk to the next enormity, and there's these guys, these South Asians, Southeast Asians, East Africans, who are working, you know, 10, 12, 11, whatever, however many hours a day. And they're making, according to the estimates at the time, you know, human rights observers were saying they were making like $6 a day, $7 a day, living 10 to a head out in, you know, labor camps out in the desert that aren't even on the tourist maps.
And where they're living, I mean,
The area that they were put off to would be, you know, out in the desert, you know, kind of hidden from anybody's view. I mean, you take a bus if you're one of the workers, and they have rides that get you back to your camp, but it's totally put away and hidden from view. You really have to go look for it. And I would 99% of tourists don't even really think about, you know, where these guys go. And so they go back off to their camps all day and at night and sleep, tend to a room, and for years at a time. And, you know, my dad, and I don't, in some ways it's almost obscene to draw a comparison between a middle class life in Ohio and what these guys have to go through. But my dad was gone a lot when I was a kid because he had to work second shift, third shift, work on weekends, stuff like that. I knew what it was to be a kid to not see my dad as much as I'd want to. Well, these guys sign up for 2 years, 3 years to leave their homes in Nepal, in India, in Sri Lanka, wherever, to be able to send money home. That's $6 a day. That's nothing to us. That's actually a lot to them. Nepal, where you're making $1 a day, maybe $1.50, $2 a day, these guys can save a couple of dollars and send them home. Then they're taking care of their kids. They're able to do this. So they're in this hell, mind you, because they love their children. And this started sinking in on me while I was in Dubai. And I've been handed the luckiest break a guy can have. Here, live like a billionaire. You don't even have to, like, oppress anybody first. Go, be a billionaire. Go, stay in the hotels and live the life. And I just couldn't, I think anybody else in the same situation, I really do believe anyone listening to this would have made the same choice. I just thought to myself, okay, I was handed this. I should figure out a way to share it. This is just right. So I had 20 grand saved up from the Forbes travel. And I really didn't know what to do with it. I looked at a lot of different charities, and the thought crossed my mind innocently of, gosh, I wish there was like an eBay or a something like that, where people, like in the developing world, all these villages where these people come from, where they could like upload their projects, what they want to do to make their economy better so they don't have to do all this. And it occurred to me that about 6 months earlier or something, I had actually heard of such a thing, this charity in San Francisco called Kiva. And so I started using Kiva and went to the website, logged in, created an account, and started putting the money in little drips and drabs.
Do you remember what some of the first places you invested in were?
Yeah, absolutely. The first ones, you know, the first one, you always remember your first. The first ones that really made impressions on me, they're listed in the book. There was a guy named Pung Teek. He's a Cambodian farmer who, he lives in a, I'm trying to remember the exact state. Anyway, it's pretty remote. And apparently, from the description, the guy, he's raising three teenagers, and he's 40 years old, mind you. And his job is to tap the trees on his land that create sugary sap, and he can refine that into sugar or wine for sale. But the trees apparently are very thick at the trunks, and so the only place he can tap them are up at the top. So dude is like 40 years old, and he's supporting three teenagers in the Cambodian sun by shinnying up and down palm trees all day. And I looked at that, and I thought, that is a different life. That is a guy, and the work ethic, and this is a guy making the best of what he's got, and he's doing it for his kids. It just really hit me. There was a guy named Victor in Paraguay who I did not loan to. His loan had already been filled on Kiva. But his job, all he wanted to do was he wanted to get some money so he could finance buying strips of leather and citronella so that he could cut them up and make mosquito repellent bracelets for the kids. Paraguay at the time was going through an outbreak of dengue fever, tropical disease that we don't have much of in America, but which strikes tens of millions of people in the developing world, particularly in the tropics. I've had dengue fever. I had it once in one of my earlier travels. It's awful. It's not fun, and it kills, you know, kids. People die. A second case can go hemorrhagic, and it's ugly and tragic. And so this guy is trying to borrow, it was like a couple of $100. I don't remember the exact figure. He's trying to borrow a couple of $100 so that he can help the kids in his village not be bitten by mosquitoes carrying dengue in the middle of a dengue epidemic. Oh, yeah, I can front you $25 until payday, dude. So I'm sitting there, and I start clicking, and I start making these loans. And then the next question is, does it work? And, well,
because you're wondering, you're remote, yeah. You're just at your computer.
Yeah. So I think every Kiva lender, I think there's like 900,000 or a million people now who've made Kiva loans. Everybody kind of wants to go through the computer, through the looking glass and sort of, you know, is it real? Is it really happening? Does this all work? Well, I've been a travel writer. I had experience doing that stuff. And, you know, I'm a writer. I tell people stories. Well, maybe I can figure this out. So I got a book contract, not sure what I was going to find. It was a pretty small advance because the publisher really had no idea what I was going to really find either. But it was enough to get the travel started. And that became the International Bank of Bob.
So before we get back to that part of the story, mm-hmm. Bob, I kind of want to, I mean, looking through your biography, you've lived a really remarkable life even before this. And, you know, for those of you who are wondering how, it's like, well, I wanted to travel around and I got a book advance. Well, mm-hmm. It's because you've written other books before about other aspects of your life. So I kind of want to give people a little, sure. This is your life, Bob Harris.
The emergency exits are to your left.
So you have an idea of what kind of background this guy has. And one of the things is that you did radio in L.A. back mm-hmm. in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And we could play a clip of this. You made one-minute segments that end up being syndicated to something like 75 mm-hmm. radio stations. Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and hear
some juvenilia.
Another true breakthrough from the world of science, bionic insects. Hi, folks. This is Bob Harris.
All right. So what was that experience like for you?
Well, that was really fun. I mean, I didn't really figure I'd ever wind up in radio. I didn't seek it. I was very, very lucky. When I'm telling you I'm one of the luckiest people who ever lived, I'm not kidding when I say that. I sent one demo tape. I was working as a stand-up comic, and I thought, you know, I'd like something more stable. I sent one demo tape to one radio station, the number one news station in Los Angeles, KNX. And I just kind of curious for feedback. It was just like a message in a bottle I just threw out there. And they hired me. I mean, I put it in the mail on like a Friday, and I was on the air on like Tuesday. And they just liked what I was doing. They wanted something. They'd just been having a conversation about, I was the millionth customer, and they'd been saying, you know, it'd be nice if we had somebody who was talking way too fast at 5:37 in the evening. And, you know, we'll give him 1 minute, and he'll say something that might be mildly funny. And then my tape came in, and they was like, yeah, give this guy a shot. And that turned into, within a year I was syndicated, and, you know, there was, you can look it up. There were, like, awards, and it was nice. And then 5 years of that, and it was kind of time to move on.
Right. You mentioned your stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. So you had been doing that in L.A., and this was sort of around the time of Seinfeld, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
So stand-up was kind of big at the time. Let's go ahead and hear a clip of you around 15 years ago or so doing some stand-up comedy in L.A.
Can we have my baby pictures next?
Really swell. What I'm actually talking about feeling right now, I'm feeling very old at the moment. I turned 35, which wouldn't be a big deal in most places in the world. But, well, see, a friend of mine, a very attractive young lady, is 34. She's getting cosmetic surgery to look younger. Yeah, I mean, but in this town, you know, because I'm afraid she's going to turn into one of those Beverly Hills lizard people, you know, the ones whose faces are stretched so tight they can't even blink because their ears are going to pop off at any moment. You've seen these people walking around, it looks like their nose came from a completely different addition from their face. You know, like Microsoft came out with, like, Face 2.0. And they, like, didn't get all the update discs, you know?
All right, that's Bob Harris as stand-up comedian 15 years ago, before he wrote The International Bank of Bob. We're going to hear more about that in a moment. You've done other media as well, including something called Mostly True Stories. What station was that on?
Well, before we do that, can we get out? There must be some recording of me singing Mary Had a Little Lamb when I was 6 years old that we can pull out. There's got to be something, some baby pictures or something. There was a TV show called Mostly True Stories, Urban Legends Revealed, on what is called TLC, which at one time, I want to point
out
to you,
Learning Channel.
It was at one point the Learning Channel.
Yeah, it's changed.
They should not be allowed to use those letters anymore. Like, you know, Bravo used to actually be about like symphonies and things like that. And honestly, we should, as a civilization, we need to march on the cable news companies and just, we can't stop them from doing what they're doing, but we can make them not use those words. We can just take the names back, just rip them down off the walls.
You could learn about, you know, insane axe murderers, right, who marry your mother, you know? I mean, that's a show.
Right? Learning about humiliations. The Weather Channel is probably the only thing that's accurately named on the entire... Seriously, if you go down the cable dial, that's probably it.
Back in the day when the Learning Channel was maybe more about learning,
yeah.
What was Mostly True Stories?
It was a Mythbusters-type show that was not successful. That's the simplest way to put it. It was... The producers of Mostly True Stories thought that what would attract the audience would be the stories of urban legends and trying to debunk them, rather than having really cool, fun experimenters who you want to invite in your living room. And really, you watch Mythbusters for Mac and Jamie. You know, you hang out
the
with them. The guys, let's see what they're doing. They're blowing something up, mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to just the story. So it was not as produced as well as it could have been, and it lasted a couple of years.
Well, for speaking of blowing something up, let's play a clip here of you, Bob Harris, as you're shooting a gigantic gun.
We sent out our reality tester, Bob Harris, to take a shot at it.
Tell us a little bit about this bad boy here.
Well, this is the 50 caliber Browning rifle. It's about 5.5 feet long. It weighs 32 pounds. It shoots the 50 BMG round.
This was a completely new experience for me. The gun is large. The gun is larger than a couple of NBA basketball players, actually.
All right, that's Bob Harris from the former show, Mostly True Stories, shooting a gun that was probably, what, about 6 feet long?
Yeah, it was a 50 caliber. It's like at the time, I don't know if they have something bigger now, but it's this enormous weapon that can fire around like 2 miles. And with no experience, I was able to hit a target that was only like, you know, a couple inches big from 200 yards away because the barrel's so huge. But Yeah, it's basically bowling with lead.
So this is sort of basically the part of the backstory of what led you to your worldwide tour helping to fund charities of people who have almost nothing. But there's another step along this way, which I think is really important to include, and that is your history of game show experience, because you were on the show Jeopardy 13 times?
13 times, yeah. I only won 8 of those. Sometimes it gets misstated as 13-time champion. I was on 13 times for various reasons over the course of about 10 years. Different tournaments and stuff I'd get invited to.
Well, let's hear a little bit of your experience at Radio City Music Hall in the Tournament of Champions.
A 5-time champion and a finalist in the Tournament of Champions. Now an author, comedian, and radio commentator from Los Angeles, California, Bob Harris.
And we could jump to a clip of you actually winning that round.
But Bob Harris, congratulations. You're going into the semifinals.
That's Bob Harris, the author of The International Bank of Bob, who before he wrote this story about his travels around the world to trace his Kiva loans, he was actually quite the game show, connoisseur, maybe?
A regular highwayman.
Because you were also, even when you weren't necessarily directly on a game show, you were still involved because there was that Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where a friend of yours was a little bit stymied on something about where some author from 1960 had stabbed his girlfriend with a penknife. Mm-hmm. And he called you in the phone-a-friend, and we could hear how quickly you answer that one.
Bob, in 1960, what author stabbed his second wife, Adele, with a penknife during an argument at a party?
Norman Mailer.
Bob Harris helping his friend win $250,000 on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Anyway, this is all backstory that led you to the travel writing where you were staying in the billion-dollar hotels and eventually led you to be curious about seeing the lives of people who were in need of small loans to help their lives get jump-started.
Yeah, I mean, this whole odd meandering path of my career, which has had all sorts of weird little side turns and everything. I mean, just look at it, if you need a simple way to look at it, as a guy who's having a lot of fun, leading a fairly aimless existence, just where's the next paycheck, where's the next fun? And then I really start seeing these guys who, you know, they're never going to have a life like that at all. And I've been blessed so amazingly. And also some of the motivation for it, too, is truthfully, these guys in Dubai, and I write about that, there was a look on their faces of just total exhaustion. But like also at the same time, commitment, they're going to keep doing it. And my dad, when he would work, and my dad's work is what gave me the opportunity to run around and do any of this. I can only have this fun life because my dad spent his life in a warehouse. And I wasn't grateful for that when I was a kid. In fact, I was angry about it. I missed him. I couldn't see him. I didn't know where he was. He wasn't home. He's working or he's working second shift or whatever. We didn't spend enough time together. And what he was doing was he was actually making this life for me indirectly, just as this giant act of faith, not even knowing that I'd have this opportunity. And now that I'm around 50, I kind of understand that, and I get that, and I'm grateful. And he's gone, and I can't say thanks to him. But there are these guys right in front of me in Dubai who, okay, they are in... So in a way, I think maybe I wanted to do something because it was the closest thing. These guys are dads. I can help these families. I can't help my family. Dad's gone, but there's these families. So I got involved in taking the money that I had that I'd gotten this particular way and putting it in the loans and traveling to see the results. And what I found everywhere I went, and including places I never figured I'd feel comfortable. I loved Lebanon. I had a great time there. I was really comfortable in Rwanda. I would walk across Kigali in the middle of the night probably 1,000 times before I'd feel comfortable walking across San Francisco in the middle of the night. It's actually a very, very safe city. I had an amazing set of trips, and everywhere I met, I kept meeting families that are so much more like our families than we would ever have imagined. You know, you see the TV news and it's things blowing up and it's people with funny languages and rituals and it's all scary on the evening news. And there's a lot of people who really, they derive their power from keeping us frightened of the world. You know, a lot of politicians, a terrible thing just happened, be frightened of this. The truth is the world is populated by people who want to feed their kids everywhere you go. And yeah, I'm not saying that everybody's right and great and terrific. This isn't some sort of like overly idealistic thing, but I am telling you that you plunk me in the middle of Beirut, my experience, everybody I meet is just families trying to feed their kids. And we're going to start seeing each other that way more and more fundamentally as time goes on.
That's Bob Harris. He is the author of The International Bank of Bob, which traces his journey around the world, seeing the lives of the people who he's lending money to through the Kiva organization. Can you tell me, have you stayed in touch with any of these families whom you lended money to?
The actual clients, not so much, because internet access, sometimes, you know, rural areas or whatever, that's been difficult. I'm still in touch with almost all of the translators and most of the people at the Kiva Partners. In fact, I think all of them that I met. And I should explain that when you make a loan through the charity Kiva.org, they have a partner in the field who handle the money. The local partner actually administers the loan, and you know they do the actual getting and giving of money and paperwork and all that sort of stuff. And Kiva does a whole due diligence process to make sure the partners are cool. And so as I would travel, I would find clients generally by finding the partner first, and then building a relationship, hanging out, and then, you know, kind of talking about, you know, well, maybe I could meet, is this guy in town? Is there a way I could meet that guy? And the thing is, these people are working like 12 hours a day. So having some, you know, big oblong shaped Midwesterner stroking in when they've got a 12-hour day in front of them, it's, you know, nobody's a travel agent here. So sometimes I was very short visits, sometimes they were very long, and we had time to get to know each other. But the local partners, the microfinance institutions, they're, you know, pretty high-tech, connected to the world with computers and all that. I've stayed in touch with them over the years, and you couldn't find a better bunch of people to hang out with. I mean, honestly, whether it's a Jehudi Kilimo in Kenya, and there's this guy Nat that runs that place, or the folks at Al Majmo in Beirut, or some people in India who I met, Raman Smita, who started a Kiva-like organization, and immediately became my next-door neighbors and adopted me for the weekend. Everywhere I went in the world, I was just gang-befriended. And I want people to feel that. I want people, anybody who picks up this book, I want them to feel like they're coming with me on that trip, and they're being surprised over and over and astonished by the generosity and the hard work and the shared dreams in Cambodia, in Vietnam, in the Philippines, places I never thought I was going to go or see, Morocco, Peru, over and over again.
So in your travels, what do you think you came away with? You've been all around the world. You've seen all kinds of circumstances, met all kinds of people. What did you come away with?
What did I come away with? I think the lesson I was just talking about, that sense of connection. More than anything, though, you know, I think deep down, a lot of us, maybe all of us, wish that we want to believe, and we try to believe, that maybe deep down everybody is really kind of alike on some level in the world. You know, if you have any hope for peace in your heart, you kind of have to believe that we're all pretty much alike. And by the way, world peace is possible. Walk down the street anytime and look around and just take 5 minutes and look at, in San Francisco or any city, almost anywhere in the world, look at the incredible diversity, the ancestors. Everybody's playing by the same rules. We can all get along. There's no ethnic or cultural thing. There's no reason we can't get along. World peace happens every day in every major city, in small drips and drabs all the time. But this idea that maybe we're all a little bit alike or a lot alike, I've come to believe that yes, deep down we all, the way I would say it as a joke, is that we're all one, and yes, that one can be a real jerk sometimes, but can also choose not to be. And I don't feel anymore like I have to wonder if that's true or hope that that's true. I mean, I've been to 70 countries now, and so there's still another 120 I haven't seen. So I still have a limited database. I haven't met everybody yet. There's 7 billion people. But I no longer wonder whether we're all pretty much the same. I have now personal experience in so many places of walking in, looking people in the eye, sitting down. You forget about the hat they're wearing. You forget about a religion, or you forget about some economic thing or whatever. And you're just sitting with people and you play with the kids. And I really feel anyway, like I'll never have to wonder that again. Like I know.
Do you think that because the world is becoming more interconnected and more global, there are different costs, of course, but the benefit, maybe, do you think that the next generations are growing up with this kind of experience and worldliness, that is going to make some sort of difference in the future?
Absolutely. There is, and I write about this near the end of the book, there is, and I think it's very unappreciated, and I'm just going to say something really obvious, but I just want everyone to look at something really obvious for a second. Right now, every 15-year-old in the world is growing up with a presumption of global interconnectedness. Even the ones who are poor enough and they're growing up on sort of the wrong side of the digital divide, they can look across the fence and see what's happening. And this idea, when I was 15 years old, I mean, seriously, color TV was, you know, really cool, a local broadcast color TV signal. And I've got a rectangle in my pocket now that will give me the weather in Peru while I'm getting stock quotes from Germany and, you know, emailing and texting with somebody in Malaysia, right? The world has fundamentally changed to a degree. There's never been anything comparable in human history. And changes like this, huge revolutionary changes, have always been localized in the past. You know, the Industrial Revolution started primarily in England, Europe, you know. This thing's happening all at once all over the place, and it's happening on a generational basis. 15-year-olds have a different planet to live on than I had when I was growing up. And I honestly believe that, you know, there's a thing psychologists I've read, I don't know how true this is, but I've read, and I think it's true, that when you move to a new culture, if immigrants come to a new country, it takes 3 generations to acculturate, to completely become whole and part of the new country. The first generation, they still speak the old language. It still has some of the old ways. They're trying to learn. The second generation starts adopting some of the old ways. They're still influenced. It's really the third generation that's really the native speakers of the new language. And all of this stuff that's happening with global communication right now, I think I'm part of that country that just got off the boat and speaks with a thick accent. And I think, you know, my niece and nephew who are in their 20s, I think they're part of that second generation. They kind of, you know, they're influenced by me. Their kids, you know, my niece is going to have a kid later this year. That kid is growing up as part of a generation that's never existed before. And in 40 or 50 years, there's going to be an entire generation in this world that is taking power, they're taking the reins politically, economically, socially, religious, all these things, who will have grown up with this presumption of interconnectivity. I honestly believe if we really look and see what that means, I think there's enormous hope in there. If we can just hold it together and not, like, wreck the planet for, like, 40 more years and just hold it together, I honestly do believe that they're going to see answers that would never even occur to me.